Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Gary Copeland Lilly. Gary Lilly is originally from Sandy Cross, North Carolina, and was a longtime resident of Washington, D.C., where he was a founding member of the Black Rooster Collective. He received the D.C. Commission on the Arts Fellowship for Poetry in 1996 and again in 2000, and he earned a Master's in Fine Arts and Poetry from Warren Wilson College in 2002. The Subsequent Blues is his first book. He currently lives in Asheville, North Carolina. Hi, Gary. Welcome to Prosody.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about we start off tonight with you reading some poems?
All right. This first poem I like to read is All My Lazarus Jazz. All That Lazarus Jazz is, this is my family's tribute, I'd like to say, because we've worked both sides of the holy line. I have ministers, and then I have these people who are less than that in my family. So this is my way of having fun with them. All you twice-slapped saints in the street dressed in black, his family's taking it hard. He was sick, they said, but now he's 3 days dead. You guys are just too late. I've got the blessing game. Around here, I'm the man. I take pawn on crowns and solid gold rings. So go ahead, Jesus. I'll church up the change. You do that water to wine thing. Lazarus has gone. He's in the grave. They say he is no more. You guys are just too late. I made a mojo bag. Took dust from his tomb. I burned sage and cedar in every room of his home. Yes, I fed the black cat and polished my wishbone. Had the crooked teeth conjurer look into my palm. I played my lucky number late last night and hit $5 on it straight. I'll bet you slap suckers all of that, 'cause I have faith in blood. And I like to read a poem that's for like a friend of mine, for Sergeant Daniel Anderson, Airborne. Falling through the sky, even an eagle is diminished nearing the earth. I can see you in Boston Commons, sitting on the wall, telling this story while the ballerinas smoke. The night after we got drunk in the last bar, where you dropped hundreds on the two dancers we liked the most, it was conversation you were after. You said the desert had probably long stripped the cigarette from the Iraqi smile. That blackened skull on the one road retreat, a dead man in a jeep, and how you watched the jerk in American fatigues fit the filter between the skull's teeth. How the mocking of this soldier's death troubled you all the way to South America. And now, troop, friend, you too are gone. You decided the day to leave. When the news came, a woman said it was guilt at the things you've done. I already knew by then that everything I had with her was finished. She believes all ex-soldiers should carry a load of shame. She doesn't understand the warrior way is the making of a saint. And what fills the silk suit is the fierce breath of God. The redemption in a soldier's life is to save a life. I lit a cigarette and told her. It was probably sadness over something you'd seen. This poem is called Black Heart. You can never know a woman. I was in a fast car, driving hard, and that one damn thought was rocking my rat motor mind. Four barrel in a sweet Chevy South, my candy red Impala Super Sport, rescued from a farmer's barn, parked when his son flew off to the desert storm. Rally wheels and a dusty windshield, 200 horses unrestrained, slow drivers getting out the way. I've been driving 3 hours heading home. The morning air was cool. A highway hum blew through the window, that melancholy whine. You can only hear driving alone. repair work started choking the road, and it began to rain a drawl drizzle. The morning traffic was creeping through Dixie mist. Law-abiding citizens seeking a gas station with a clean bathroom and styrofoam cups of old coffee. Drivers sitting like sticks, everyone locked into their own red-eyed existence. Construction boys, highway scrap, no idling in the closed left lane in their steel-toed shoes and stiff jeans, scratching their butts, adjusting their crotches, spitting red man juice into the gasoline and all sheen on the road. I grabbed a bottle of Jack, drank the last corner, capped it empty, shoved it back behind the seat. The sign. Two cardinals on a dogwood branch. Welcome to North Carolina. The home of Jesse Helms is just 50 years backwards as the Jim Crow flies. I was heading home to figure this all out. What's the deal with a woman who doesn't put herself into a kiss, the most intimate act anyone can do? If she doesn't give herself wholly into a kiss, you ain't got beyond the surface. And that's the real sign I'd missed. Her kisses metered out like pocket change. I roared my red car home, then screamed out my open window. I don't know one damn thing.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Gary Copeland Lilly, reading from his book, The Subsequent Blues, published by Fortway Books. So, Gary, in reading your work, and I've known your work over a number of years, there's something in your poems that's between a cautionary tale and a recruitment poster. You know, there's a lot of people who are living kind of hard lives or have lived hard lives or have had things happen to them that they're kind of ruminating about. And then at the same time, they're so engaging. Their voices are so intoxicating that there's a sense, you know, I'm not sure you always want to be them, but you want to be with them. And I just want you to talk a little bit about the people you write about, the voices you have.
Those voices, wherever I've lived in whatever environment that I've found myself in, I try to, replicate the voices I hear there, the people I live with, basically. A lot of these poems are coming out of Washington, D.C., and I lived there during what people call the crack wars, when there was all the turf battles and all that, and we were having body counts, homicides in the city at that period, probably 400 or 500 a year for a period of like 3 or 4 years. And I lived in a community that had been hit hard by that. So that community had everybody in it. It had the people, the church people, the school kids, it had the hustlers, it had the addicts, it had everybody. But what got me was that I connected with them and they connected with me simply because I happened to live there and I didn't have any judgment about them. So they used to see me and I'll be writing or taking notes and they would ask me, so when are you going to write about us? And I figure like, yeah, it's time to write about them. Yeah. So I stepped into the project then, but I want to do it honestly. I want to do it so that you don't see like a stereotype of, oh, this is the hustler dude or something like that. But I'd rather show you the archetype here of this individual with these traits who is in that realm and that on that path or whatever. But I try to be honest with what they really feel and to show them as having some integrity of thought, even in their actions, no matter what the actions are, you know, that there's this thought that they're reacting to things as they know best and that there is a force within them too. There is some type of, I would say, God force in them.
There's a real humanness. You know, yes. There is, you can you can tell in your work that you're trying to look at it, I wouldn't even say necessarily with an objective eye, because it's not looking beyond their humanity. It's actually kind of looking at them in terms of their humanity.
I think what it is, and is an emphatic eye, is
that's a good term.
I want to not just create this like a character, the persona. The most important thing about the persona or the vehicle that really hits us with that in the construction of a poem is the voice. Mm-hmm. And when I'm talking about voice, I'm talking about not the any poet's or writer's aesthetic style. That's just, to me, aesthetic style. But the voice is the character speech, that what rises off the page and what gets into our ear and stuff. And I want that voice, that individual voice, to come true. I want it to seem like you're listening to someone who is right there in front of you. And the things that they're saying, they have to be true. I have to use concrete details, very credible details for this person to make it happen. But the humanity is that I want you to recognize them as being a person.
Yeah. Well, let's do a little more rising off the page and into people's ears. How about you read some more poems?
This one is from the Subsequent Blues. It's called Not in the Rap Sheet or the Obituary. Lil Pete gets tired of arguing with Wilson about the quality of the dope he sold and Wilson smoked 2 hours ago when he turns to leave. Wilson, unwilling to see the pocket full of coke he imagines in Pete's jacket walk away without him, reaches out a hand to slow Pete's step. Catching the move from the corner of his eye, Pete swirls to face him, hair-triggered Glock already in hand, coming up the side of Wilson's head. Wilson's flounder rise big up fast. He opens his mouth to make a plea just as Pete shoots him. One round between his left ear and eye. Wilson collapses on twitching and stitching into the sidewalk. Little Pete stands stiff in that bullet hole of silence. In a matter of seconds, he was completely alone. And this one is also from D.C. It's a personal one, but it's from D.C. Dear Jeffrey, I don't care if you're crazy. Do you remember your coma? The windshield of the Ford ate the red light in you right out the crosswalk? You were hooked to machines. I couldn't imagine that you were down, making me love so much my own life. Your skull x-rayed and the fractures looked like constellations had fixed themselves in your mind. Safety glass kept working out of your scalp. We both in the bottle 1 year later. You said you died and came back, so it must have been the devil's hand. Nothing new about death, you said. What messed you up is life unlived. Cool and the gang, cars and clothes. I watched you drive the settlement to whatever spot you sleep in now. I've eroded and protect myself with tattoos. What do you do? Are your voices saviors and your layers of shirts shields? Aunt Marcel is dead. Do you remember, younger brother, how she loved you? Can you hear me saying this from Washington, D.C.? I live around First No Street and see the homeless. This is where they eat. Crazy drunks, a lost tribe, roams from Whitehurst Bridge, dry mouth hungry, a muddy face, and I can't guess how you look now, Jeffrey. Does a woman sleep next to you? What a 17 years gone will your madness show me? How many times have you died?
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the poet Gary Copeland Lilly, reading from his book, The Subsequent Blues, from Four Way Press, from Four Way Books. Sorry about that, Gary.
That's all right.
I want to ask you something about you know, you've got a lot of influence from the blues. You know, the title kind of tips the hand to that. There's definitely some gospel influence in your work. And there's other sounds. You know, there's a certain amount of sounds or rhythms that come into your work. And this might sound a bit like a strange question, but when you're writing your work, what is it you hear? Is that stuff playing in your mind as you're doing it? Is it something that you go in and work back into the text once you kind of have the story of what you're going to be on? Like, because it's very evident in the work.
Actually, it probably works both ways. Sometimes I just have a rhythm that I can start with and to just, like, unplug in stuff for that. I mean, I have a subject. It's not random. But so I want to plug in the sounds that make that happen. And then, like, I remember reading stuff from Sylvia Plath and going through the many, many drafts of everything she has, because mm-hmm. she does save drafts. She did. Mm-hmm. And so you could kind of, like...
She might still. We don't know.
she kind of tracks... you can track her. And interesting thing, I forget the poem now, but there was one line that was in this poem. And you know the final poems. So you're seeing the draft, and what this line does not make sense. It doesn't fit this poem anywhere. So later on, I'm starting to see what she did was I want this line to have this rhythm. Hmm. So she used words that created that rhythm.
Right.
And then she plugged the image in with that same rhythm that later. But I like to work like that. But I try to work sound more so than rhymes. I think that's a more subtle music, and it's a more intimate music to work word sounds.
How do you make choices, though? And maybe it's some of it's the content. Maybe some of it's just the way that it first comes to you when you hear it. Between like when you're going to have more of a gospel influence or more of a blues influence, because kind of I see the subjects of your work as kind of a community. And, you know, right, you were talking before right. about the different voices that come out, but it also, it almost feels like, you know, you're almost like walking by different clubs. Like maybe you're past a church and then you're next to a blues club kind of thing. And
well, that isn't as far apart as people like to think it is. If you know something about the blues, I mean, just the whole history of it, you find these people in the 1920s and 30s or so. I'm talking about Robert Johnson, Jolly Patton. And then we can get into like some Son House, those type of people, you know. One, there's the music and the language to start with. But I don't think that when I look at gospel and blues, well, they all sung the same songs. The music comes from the same place.
Right.
And that battle of the secular over the sacred and stuff, it never really applied to me and stuff, you know, because I had people in my family who would play the blues and sing the blues, and then I had all these church songs too. And like it's kind of funny, like the church songs that I can sing now that I still remember are basically the songs that my grandmother sung around the house, as well as the congregation in the church, you know. And like I do those, and people like, see, that's a blues. No, that's a gospel, but it is the blues and stuff, you know. I think all those forms start the same place.
Yeah.
You know, we put the distinctions on them that where one is sacred and one is secular, but, you know, just with the words, but the tones,
right.
That's all the same to me.
Well, and I also think sound in terms of, and I'm probably leading you here a little bit because it's one of the poems of yours I'm familiar with and I really like, and I hope you'll read it. You also pay attention to sound because you served on a submarine for a long time.
Oh, that's the world sound.
Yeah, and just, and I don't think people think of that. You know, they probably think it's like when you're sitting at the bottom of a pool and you just hear, you know, kind of funny water sounds in your ears. But, you know, there's a way that you pay attention to sound and then translate it into to your poems that it's these are sounds that other people haven't heard before.
When I was on the sub, I was in the Navy for 10 years and I was with the U.S. Submarine Force. I was on a missile platform, and you're used to always being around some machinery noise, some people. Somebody's always up. Somebody's always walking to Burbank. There are sounds coming from the galley where someone's cooking. It's like, you know, just it's a bunch of people who are living inside this enclosed space, and then they drop it as near as they can to hell, probably. I don't know. They, you know, they just take it down. But so you have this community where everybody functions there, and everything is happening, air, water, hydraulics, all the electrical equipment. You know, we track people through frequencies. We, you know, everything is just sound and you know, folk and stuff. You know, that's why they have these commands, run silent, run deep, and all this kind of stuff. But the thing is, it's such a part of our environment that it is the backdrop for everything. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting about submarines. I didn't start writing anything about submarines up until 2000 when the Russian submarine, the RS Kursk, went down. Because we didn't really care too much for Russian sailors at that time, especially Russian submariners. They're always hunting us, so we're hunting them, and we're playing our little weird games and stuff, you know, which, you know, that's what submariners do. We weren't cowboys, but not my ship, not my captain. He was very much about it, a very fair guy, but definitely professional. So we know that they're hunting us, and we think we have the superior technology, and we can definitely hunt them. So there's no love lost between these two navies, and especially these two submariners. But the curse went down, and it dredged up a whole lot of memories I have about being submerged or being on land as a submariner, which is when they really get in trouble, you know. At sea, they're a different type of creature. But just about being submerged, I identified with the entire crew of that Russian submarine. Why? The pictures of the people there and the ages were just like us. They're just like we were at that time. And you get to see 19-year-old machinist mates and, like, officers who are 23 or 4 years old. And, you know, these guys are just starting their families or just... This is their first real serious job for a lot of them. They're trying to prepare for the future, just like we were doing. And this ship went down in 300 feet of water, which is a shallow depth for a submariner. Yeah. And the Russian Navy didn't have the capability of rescuing them and refused our help, which we would have done the same thing. It's just part of the ruse. Our rule is the same. No foreign nationals will ever be allowed to come on our ship just to see what we have or don't have. And they're like us, too. This was during the Cold War.
Can you read that poem?
Yeah. This poem is, So I Come Back. But this is a good title. This is my blues title to the submarine poem. So I come back and find that now she's taking the TV. That black and white set on loan so long, it was mostly mine. A grateful receiver of all gifts, probably because I'm Southern, and was living in 300 square feet of studio when she told me to take it because I had nothing else but window and wall. She knows. I like the small homicide of Friday night. But it's funny. When some people see you down once, they can never see you as anything but. I've had 4 broken noses, played street ball, and fought in bars before both turned deadly. Nothing kills a dream faster than a pistol. Nothing unplugs you like a woman who feels you did her wrong. And that's regardless of the proof of the bourbon you submerge into the draft. A Russian submarine sits on the Arctic shelf tonight, within reach now only of God. The poor bastards have been sacrificed for the secrecy of ordnance and equipment. I shot expert with the 45, ready to repel all borders, kill any invaders, go ballistic, nuke the world from my submarine. Couldn't wait to play the games with the Russians. shaking Ivan before going out on patrol. Loaded with cigarettes, a war chest of porn, a few Bibles, weightlifting gloves, and steel-toe boots. This was my bubblehead prayer prior to going to sea. May the number of surfaces equal the dives. May the number of surfaces equal the dives. May the number of surfaces equal the dives. Big black American submarine. We didn't do TV. We didn't watch it unless we were home. Maybe in the afterglow and some woman's arms. But tonight, nothing goes deeper to the man than living inside the machine. And I'm contemplating the loss of air, stuck beneath the thermals, in the damned thinness, in the cold, lack of time.
I'm going to ask you if you'll read one more quick poem, and I'm even going to ask you to read a particular one. It's the one where you're in jail, the persona's in jail.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about going to jail for poetry.
This poem is titled, I'm Going to Live Long Unless Something Kills Me. I was the oldest guy in the holding cell. The soft gloss on my Timbo boots, the loose tongue flapping through, an absence of strings, and the way my beltless baggy jeans sag without falling off my waist. Because none of that was troubling me, to the hustlers waiting the magistrate, it somehow seemed to say, I've been there before. But these days, the police no longer allow lockdowns to have cigarettes, and the only time I don't smoke is when I'm asleep, but that's out of the question, so I sit head up, folded securely in my military jacket, and quietly fiend to myself a pledge not to want a Marlboro until I make bail, and not to eat the bologna sandwiches handed out by the gap-mouthed trustee who for some reason has a smile at 4:30 a.m. in the 3rd District Jail. I just want to think how my whole night turned on the blade of a jackknife. From the smile of a short woman crazy about the unauthorized use of her in my poem. 3 drinks deep at the bar when a brother's big as a fridge and wearing his hat backwards shows up and starts talking trash. A thick spliff Rasta roll for the zigzag love of the Lord in my pocket. Hallelujah. There's a prayer to Stagger Lee. The ghetto saint who knows I ain't got a fair fight left to give anybody. And now I was getting the nod of respect for the assault with a deadly charge. And I told the youngins, this stuff was all about art.
You've been listening to the poetry of Gary Copeland Lilly, reading from Subsequent Blues from 4-Way Books. Thanks for coming to Prosody, Gary.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Waity. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wolk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.